morning. I just want to alert the lawyers that while they're arguing, a group of high school students may come in, so that may cause some issues of noise. And that will be the Deerfield High School students. But we have with us the University of Wisconsin-Stevens Point Student Legal Society. Would they please stand? Welcome, and you may be seated. The University of Wisconsin-Stevens Point Student Legal Society has come to this court for maybe more years than each of you has been alive. Can't give you the exact year, but quite a long time. And we always welcome you. And I assume that you have gotten a summary of the case we're about to hear. And when the Deerfield High School students come, they're part of a program sponsored by the Supreme Court and the State Bar. It's called, cleverly, Court with Class. And it is a national award-winning program and adopted by other states, mimicking what we have done here. And we invite all the high schools in the state to come. If they accept the invitation, they're given materials about the case. They come, they listen to oral argument, and after the second case, which is about 12:15, they meet with a justice of the court and discuss the procedures of the case and how we handle cases, take them and decide them, not the substantive issues of law. And you are all welcome to join at noon. And when the Deerfield High School comes in, I'll make further announcement about this, or at least when there's a break in the argument. So our first case today is 09AP2917D, Office of Lawyer Regulation versus Mitchell J. Barrick. And arguing on behalf of Mitchell J. Barrick is Terry E. Johnson. Mr. Johnson. Did I pronounce the name of your client properly?
You did correctly. Thank you, Chief Justice, Justices of the Court. I have the privilege of appearing before you to represent the respondent appellant, Mr. Barrick. This case arises out of what we view as fairly simple, essentially, basically uncontested facts. And if these facts are understood, the result and the error by the referee in both the findings and the recommendations, I think, will become apparent. It is undisputed that Mr. Barrick represented a group of clients spearheaded by Marilyn Granger, who had a potential interest in the estate of their uncle, Anthony Schuster. It is undisputed, even though we were not permitted to put the full evidence into the record by what we believe were erroneous rulings by the referee, that Mr. Barrick and Ms. Granger had made substantial efforts to attempt to evaluate the question of whether he had a will and whether it was valid, and that they had ample reason to believe that any will that Mr. Schuster had executed was invalid because he had lacked testamentary capacity. It is essentially undisputed that at the time Mr. Schuster died, there was one person in the world whose testimony was essentially critical, absolutely essential to having justice done concerning his estate, a nephew, cousin of the plaintiffs, the claimants here, who was intimately acquainted with Mr. Schuster, who would have knowledge of his testamentary capacity that no one else would have, and by bad luck, that nephew was himself terminally ill and was believed to be on the edge of death, could die at any moment, so that the time Mr. Schuster died, delay of perhaps even hours, but certainly delay of days, would have a disastrous effect upon Mr. Barrick's clients. It's also absolutely undisputed that the form that, by statute and by procedure, has to be completed in order to commence a probate administration had two boxes that Mr. Barrick and his client had to choose from. And I think it's essentially undisputed that neither one of them is right. There's a really wrong one, and there's a kind of wrong one. The really wrong one said that he knew there was a valid will and required him to, and his client to provide detailed information about what the will provided. That wasn't true because he didn't know there was a valid will. He believed to the contrary, as did his client, and because he couldn't provide the information, because despite his diligent efforts going back over an extended period of time to get information about the will, he had been frustrated at every turn. The other box said there's no will, and that's the least wrong one. And it is in this case that under those facts, the fact that Mr. Farrick assisted his client in filing the petition with that box checked, that forms the entire basis for this proceeding. And it is our position that under those circumstances, there is no rule implicated, there is no violation of any rule, there is no reason why this should even have been pursued in the first place. Because the rules that my client is accused of having violated are threefold. One of them is clearly inapplicable, and how he could have been found to have violated it is beyond me. One says you have to bring controlling authority to the attention of the court. That's a rule that says that if I know a case, a precedent, a statute in Wisconsin which controls something, I have to bring it to the attention of the court, even if my opponent doesn't. That has nothing to do with this. And it is perhaps symptomatic of the way we lost ourselves in this proceeding that was charged and found by the referee, when in fact it doesn't fit the facts at all. The other two rules basically require, under decisions of this court and the clear language of the rules and the plain meaning of those words, as we've explained at length in our brief, a finding that by assisting his client in checking that box and in filing it, my client engaged in conduct which was intentionally deceitful, fraudulent, dishonest. And the fact of the matter is, there is no evidence in this record to support that finding. Despite the fact that my client's opportunity to put in evidence was curtailed improperly by the referee, there's still no evidence.
Mr. Johnson, I've got a question in regard to the form. It's my understanding that the form says it can't be modified. But then there's also an indication, as I understand it, that the form can be supplemented.
That's correct.
And what occurred to me as I was reading the facts involved here was while your client couldn't modify the form, why not supplement it and fully explain what was going on here?
And that did come up in the hearing, and my client testified that in retrospect it would have been better had he envisioned all of this coming out of this. Certainly he would today go back and supplement it. But two things in response to that. Number one, there's no requirement of supplementation. There's no suggestion about what the supplementation should even be. For example, we have been accused of attacking the form. We are not attacking the form. We are recognizing the reality of the limitations of the form under the facts of this case. But the form could easily have been changed to improve this. It could have said, if you're checking this box because you don't know the details of a will or suspect it's invalid, add supplementary detail. But it doesn't say that. It just says you can supplement it, and it doesn't give any idea of how to do it. And second, I would argue to you that my client did supplement the form, because the record is clear that essentially contemporaneously, immediately after this, he did three things. Number one, he issued a subpoena, a notice for the deposition to take the cousin's deposition. Number two, he gave notice to everyone the statute required be given notice of these proceedings so that the entire process was entirely transparent. Steps that were intended to and absolutely clearly calculated to have someone file the will if there was an arguably valid will and have the issues resolved. And third, he even gave notice to people who didn't deserve notice. He sent a letter to Mr. Binzak, the lawyer he'd been in touch with already, explaining what was going on. He sent a letter to the person in the world, the one person in the world that was most likely of all the people he knew to bring up and raise this issue of the will, because that's what he wanted to do. The suggestion of OLR that by checking this box he was trying to hide this issue, that he was trying not to have it come out, is shown to be false by the conduct of Mr. Barrick in immediately notifying everyone so that these issues would come out. And this is all in the context where there is no evidence at all that this document is used in any consequential way by anyone.
Let me just ask you that.
Justice Abrams, if I could just finish one thought.
Sorry.
I apologize, because it's important for this thought. To the contrary, the evidence is uncontradicted, because it's, the only evidence is the testimony of my client, that in fact, the way this would come up is at the first appearance before either the court commissioner or the probate judge, the entire matter would be explained that that's what happened in this case, and that the judge had no problem with what happened. The judge is not a complainant here. The judge is not a witness here. The person allegedly defrauded, the person allegedly lied to, from all indications, has no problem with what happened. I apologize, Justice Abramson.
No. In effect, that was the, you answered in part the question I was going to ask, which is, as I read this, the I thought we were going to be dealing with a case where the lawyer has a client who will personally benefit if there is no will.
And it was possible, at least, that Ms. Granger would benefit if there was no will. There's no dispute about that.
That there would be intestacy and...
And I believe she and her cousins would be the statutory heirs, if I understand it.
Of over $1 million.
I know it was a lot of money. I don't recall the amount.
Somewhere I read the estate was valued at somewhere like $1 million.
More than I've ever inherited.
All right. Well, but there's maybe your family will inherit from you.
My father's estate plan was on his license plate. It said, I'm spending my children's inheritance. I didn't realize it wasn't just a joke until we probated his estate, and then I realized it was his estate plan.
I had a similar father. I mean, that's the underlying concept here. And you're saying that, okay, filled out the form, checked box 7, because there was no box 8 that's or 9 or 8, 7A that said something between 6 and 7.
Other, please explain.
Right. But do you have to show here that that's the motive? Do you have to show harm?
I don't think we're not arguing they have to show harm. And I suppose, you know, we could turn this around. I've met Mrs. Granger briefly. She testified at the hearing. I don't know whether she was doing it for the money or whether she was doing it because she felt the family should benefit in a will that she thought was improperly drafted was should not be admitted. I can't speak to her motives, but let's assume the worst. She was doing it for the money. That's what we hire lawyers for. We do it, clients do that a lot. But we're not arguing that we have to show that there was a good motive behind this. Her motives were her motives. What we are saying is that under the language of the rules, under the case law, that there has to be some showing that my client intended by his own conduct and by assisting his client in this to achieve some fraud, some dishonesty, to fool someone, to trick someone, to do something wrong. And there's no showing of that at all. In fact, when it's viewed in the totality of the conduct, this should be seen as, in its absolute worst, a misjudgment in failing to add the supplement, under circumstances where no one else ever thought there should be a direction that it be supplemented or asked for this information, and under circumstances where there is no evidence that anybody considers this document to be of consequence. Now, I'm not going to be like Edward Ben Elson and say only obey good laws or anything of that kind, but the fact of the matter is it should make a difference in assessing both my client's conduct and the consequences of that conduct, whether this is a meaningful document with actual impact on the system or whether this is, for want of a better term, a form.
Who was the complainant, Counselor?
My understanding was Mr. Binzak, the lawyer who was involved in the drafting of the will, who my client had had an ongoing disagreement with for some time about whether he could see the will and about whether some earlier means of getting information could be pursued. I'd like to shift to a slightly different subject, and that is this.
Did Binzak get notice?
Yes, Binzak got a letter immediately afterward. And, of course, what happens here is exactly what should happen. Letters went out. Two things were discovered. First thing that was discovered was that the will that had been signed, which was the suspect will, was filed. Before anything of substance happened, it was learned that there was a second earlier will that was essentially identical to the suspect will in its bequests. And it therefore was determined that it didn't matter whether the will at question was valid or not. The result was going to be the same because the earlier will, there was no issue about competency on. So the whole issue was resolved.
Is my recollection of the record accurate that your client had contacted Attorney Binczak several times prior to when he submitted this form for the purpose of finding out if there was a will?
And to get a copy. Both, he had done that both informally by contacting him, and he had actually tried to commence a court proceeding that would permit him to do discovery. That request was turned down. It was pushing the envelope on litigation, but it shows that the kinds of efforts my client was trying to do to get this information before.
And when your client contacted Attorney Binczak, what was Attorney Binczak's response?
The substantive response was, none of your business, I'm not giving it to you.
Counsel, the referee found, as a fact, that on January 16, 2009, both Barrett and Granger knew that Schuster had executed a will. And the referee indicated, as Justice Crooks referenced, that Barrett could have supplemented the form petition to disclose to the court that a will had been executed and explained to the court that he did not think it was valid. The referee said that Barrett's reason for not supplementing the petition boils down to, and I quote, I knew that if there was a will, someone else would file it.
I would agree in large part with everything except the last part. I don't accept the referee's characterization of his position. His position was that it didn't occur to him to supplement it. There's no requirement to supplement it, that he didn't see that supplementing it would add anything to it in light of his existing intentions to notify everyone to accomplish more than the supplementation would have provided. If he had supplemented the will, that wouldn't have provided any notice to any of the people who were interested in it. He went one better. He provided direct notice to them of the fact that this proceeding had started, in effect explained to them the urgency because of the cousin's health situation, and took the steps necessary to provide everyone who truly cared about the situation with more information than the supplementation would have provided.
But couldn't those facts arguably be called a misrepresentation to the court in the petition, because he arguably knew a will existed?
I don't think that I question the referee's finding that he knew a will existed, but even accepting that,
well, I mean,
it's not a misrepresentation for two reasons. Number one, there's no requirement in the form that you provide that supplementation, number one. Number two, there's no requirement in the statutes that the form is based on that that information be provided. And number three, there's no case law that says that that information has to be provided. So if you hold in this case that my client committed a misrepresentation by not supplementing it, it will be the first time any lawyer in Wisconsin has received any indication from anyone that that's a violation of these rules.
Well,
and it would be unfair to subject my client to discipline when he had no notice that it was a violation.
Let me just, this may be out in left field, but comes to mind a requirement for divorce proceeding. You have to be a resident of the county, was it 30 days or 60 days next preceding the commencement of the divorce. The attorney files the petition, that's the assertion, and if the attorney finds in between time that that's not true, what obligation, if any, does the attorney have to bring to the court's attention that what's set forth in the petition and signed by the attorney is in error?
If that representation had been made and it hadn't been brought to anyone, by the attention of the court, by anyone else, I think you'd have a duty to correct it because it goes to the jurisdiction of the court.
Okay, but even if it didn't, is the essence of your question, oh, he has a duty to correct it, my hypothetical, because it goes to the jurisdiction of the court? Or is it he has a duty to correct it because he knows it's not true?
I think it goes to the first. If the statement, for example, if he learned that the petition said they lived on 2nd Street and they lived on 3rd Street, but he knew all the notices and everything else were going out to the correct addresses, I would not feel compelled in any way to notify the court that there's an error in the address of my client.
It seems to me your response is whether or not the representation is material. That's what I hear you saying, that a typographical error and a change of address isn't material. And so the question would be, in my hypothetical, is lack of residence in the county material misrepresentation to the court? I'd argue, because it goes to jurisdiction, it does. Then a corollary question in this proceeding was the check on the box that there was not a will material to the court in this probate proceeding.
And the answer is, on this record, it is not, because there is no evidence at all that anyone takes any action based upon that box being checked, number one. The record is uncontradicted that my client expected to be giving a full explanation to the court at the initial appearance, that he did do it and that the court had no problem with it. And third, to the extent anyone is to get notice of the fact that there may be some issue about a valid will, that was accomplished through sending the letters. So if the issue is, did my client act in a dishonest, deceitful, fraudulent way by doing it the way he did it instead of adding the supplement, I think the answer to that is no, or at least that, if you're now going to say prospectively that that's the law, it ought not be applied to my client to discipline him when there was no way he could know that when he filled out the form.
What, if any, consideration should there be for this court with regard to his prior discipline? His prior discipline includes, as I recall, a 60-day suspension, which includes making misrepresentations. Let me be blunt, lying during a deposition or make, I don't know what the right word is, but not telling the truth or making a misrepresentation. And then, as I recall, the part of the discipline that we imposed was also for making a misrepresentation, wasn't it, to OLR?
I don't recall that part. But my client was charged with making misrepresentations and was suspended for that earlier. What I will tell you is that I think the record shows my client learned his lesson. That's why he over-disclosed to people he didn't have to disclose. That's why he went to the Milwaukee County Court Commissioner to get advice before he filed the form so that he could try to do this properly, was told by the Milwaukee County Court Commissioner what to do, and did exactly what did. Now, I'm not saying that's a complete defense, but if you're asking me how ought one factor in these prior misjudgments on his part, one should say, look at the record on this, and I think the conclusion is he went above and beyond what you would expect a lawyer to do. And the reason he did it, I suspect, is an understandable overreaction, or maybe a proper reaction, to the obvious misjudgments he made in these other matters, so that he would not be accused of these things. So I think it's relevant, but I think it's helpful to us, not harmful.
Counsel, you said a few moments earlier that your client fully disclosed all of these matters at the first court appearance. What did he tell? What does the record show that he told the court?
It's a very brief colloquy, and all the testimony amounts to is what I said. This was discussed in full at the first court appearance. The trial judge had this explained to him, and the trial judge had no problem with it.
You're using a lot of shorthand here. I want to know.
I think that's essentially what was said. It's two lines of testimony in the record. I can give you the page number. It is on two pages, pages 78 and page 120 of the transcript, particularly at page 120. But it is a very brief and general description of it. I'm virtually quoting it.
Okay, paraphrase it. Paraphrase it. What did he tell the court?
Paraphrase is, he didn't say what he told the court. What he said is, this was all gone over with the court at the initial appearance, and the judge had no problem with it.
Okay.
It's really no more detailed than that. I'd like to shift to two other short issues since I'm coming down to the end of my time. And they both relate, unfortunately, because I don't like standing up here accusing someone of not doing their job, to the way referee Volke handled the hearing. I honestly don't know how much time you individually spend reading the transcript. The transcript of the hearings in this case are not long. I will tell you, it is impossible for any fair-minded person to read that and not come to the conclusion that, number one, referee Volke prejudged this case. Number two, the referee Volke did not want to spend time on this and was only concerned with how much time he spent, not with justice, the facts, and the law. And number three, that as a result, my client didn't get a fair hearing. When we made an error in responding to the motion for summary judgment in how we entered it on our calendar and realized it and corrected it within days and provided a detailed affidavit explaining the efforts we made to comply with his rule, how we made the error, and why it wasn't prejudicial. His response was, I read this, you just didn't do it. I'm sorry. That's not true. That's not true. It's unfair. It bespeaks an abuse of discretion. It shows no willingness to judge this matter fairly. Number two, when he decided on summary judgment without notice and contrary to the summary judgment procedure that he was going to transform summary judgment into making factual findings that would be binding at trial, he violated the law. It's not right. That's not what happens. I can go to a summary judgment hearing and say, we're not contesting any of their allegations for purposes of this motion. Instead, we're saying, under the law, we're still entitled to a trial. That doesn't mean all those facts are established for the trial. That's what he did. He invented a new procedure that's not even described in his motion. Third, he cut off my client repeatedly when he was testifying, accused him of not answering questions when the fact is he was, wouldn't listen to relevant evidence, made bad rulings, made a terrible ruling that the probate court had determined the validity of the will and that my client, who wasn't a party to that proceeding, who wasn't in privity with anyone in the proceeding, didn't understand the difference between privity of contract and privity for purposes of issue preclusion, and wouldn't let us put in the evidence, wouldn't let my client put in the evidence he wanted to put in on why he believed things and did things after saying at the summary judgment hearing, I understand these facts, I wanted your client's explanation of what he knew and why he did it, and then cut it off. And last, and worst, dictated major portions of his decision before he allowed us to argue the case. Now, what would those of you who have been trial judges do if you found out that the jury was writing out its verdict in the half-hour gap between when the evidence was completed and the time instruction started? You'd say, my goodness, you can't do that. You can't be reaching conclusions. We tell juries that every day, many times during a trial day. He did exactly that. This was not a fair trial. The result that should occur in this is very simple. If you believe, accept our position, Mr. Barrick is entitled to a decision by this court dismissing this complaint. The evidence did not support a decision that he violated any rule, and the findings are unsupported by the critical and undisputed evidence. Alternatively, if you have some doubts about that, we're entitled to a new hearing with a different referee, with a ruling that permits us to put in the full case, that doesn't hamstring us by rulings that have no purpose other than to save time, irrespective of the effect it has on my client's rights, and, I'm sorry, not before referee Volkey. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Representing the Office of Lawyer Regulation is Attorney Cheryl St. Orris.
Good morning. This matter is here on appeal by Attorney Barrick regarding the recommendation report of referee Judge Timothy Volkey. Judge Volkey issued a detailed report and recommendation, and that report and recommendation provides that OLR satisfied its burden of proof as to the two claims the count set forth in the complaint. This court's review of that report as set forth in the unique disciplinary rules provides standards of review. And one of those standards is quite important. The referee's findings of fact are reviewed under the clearly erroneous standard. The referee's conclusions of law, which find that the violations in this case are proven, are reviewed on a de novo basis. And the court independently reviews, there were some questions about sanction. The validity of the will in this case is not an issue. It's not the validity of the will. It's the existence of the will as it pertains to PR 1901, the form that the respondent filled out. That existence of the will is important, and it is a theme that has to run through the case because that's where the misconduct occurred. I'd like to start with a very brief overview. Counsel has presented their understanding of the facts, and we believe that some of those are different in our presentation of the facts. Anthony Schuster executed a will, as did his wife, in 2005. Attorney Barrick represented a client, that would be Mr. Schuster's niece, who had an interest in that probate estate. It's important to note that that probate estate had a value in excess of $1.5 million. The Schusters died without children. Mr. and Mrs. Schuster met with their attorney, Mr. Binzak, and duly executed their last wills. Mrs. Schuster predeceased her husband, and prior to the death of Mr. Schuster, Attorney Barrick attempted to obtain information about the wills executed by the Schusters. It seems his client thought the wills were invalid. Respondent even filed a motion, and I'm bringing forth these facts because we need to know what facts were in the respondent's mind. He brought forth a motion prior to Mr. Schuster's death, engaging in understanding he filed a motion for discovery to find out how the wills were executed after 2005. Filed a motion with the court prior to the testator's death. The judge said, no, you can't do discovery regarding an individual if they're not dead yet, and denied the motion. So we can assume at that time he was concerned about the wills.
What was the substance of the motion that you're referring to? What did he want to do, and what was denied by the court?
He wanted to do discovery and do depositions. He wanted to conduct depositions.
Of whom?
I don't recall, but I assume he wanted to find out who executed the will, if there was a will, where the will was located. He wanted to find out about the will.
Okay.
Did he want to find out about the will, or did he want to find out about if there was a will, or don't you know?
The thrust of the record will show that he was looking towards the validity of the will. His client, Ms. Granger, thought that the will was not proper. She had gone to the court and found Annie Schuster's will, Mrs. Schuster, and found out that Annie Schuster's will was witnessed by Mr. Von Schneider. In looking at the wife's will, she found out that she wasn't getting anything. And she also knew that Attorney Binzak had prepared the will. And there was a concern on her part that maybe there was undue influence, maybe Mr. Schuster was not competent to execute the will. Two important points about that. A judge issued in a guardianship proceeding an order that stated that Mr. Schuster had a right to execute a will. With regard to that right to execute a will order of the circuit court judge, there was also an opinion provided by a doctor, Dr. Mitchell, saying that Mr. Schuster was competent to execute a will. Mr. Barrick knew about all of that. He found out about that. So with regard to the validity and searching around on part of his client, he already knew that a circuit court judge and a doctor had said he could execute a will.
Counsel, I'm a little unclear in your response. In response to Justice Rogensack, you indicated that the respondent or the petitioner here wanted to find out if there was a will. But then in response to Justice Bradley's question, you said that he wanted to find out about the validity of the will. I especially don't know in light of the responses you just gave, if he was looking to find out if there was a will at all.
I think he was, but if you allow me, as we go through, I'm going to have a list of bullet points that show that he knew there was a will. He was told by many people there was a will. And I'll get to that point if you would allow me.
I just wanted to resolve that difference in your responses to Justice Rogensack and Justice Bradley as I heard it.
Let me just clarify something in my mind, okay? The determination and order appointing a guardian on a permanent basis and for protective services, oftentimes, I mean, that also is a form. You can retain the right and be competent to vote, marry, contract, hold, convey property, have a license, or other. And here in other, it says make a will.
Yes.
Right? And then that was executed apparently in June of 2005, it looks like.
Yes.
Make a will is not the same as having a will. So what after June of 2005 is in the record that shows that Attorney Barrick knew that a will was executed?
One, Ms. Granger obtained a copy of her aunt Annie Schuster's will, and she reviewed it and gave it to Attorney Barrick.
Okay, what was the date of that?
Excuse me?
What was the date of that? I just don't have all these dates at my fingertips.
It was prior to the death. I don't know the date. I'm sorry. But Mr. Barrick then knew that John von Schneider was the witness to Annie Schuster's will. Then three, Mr. Barrick acted on his own suspicions and engaged in motion practice to try and take depositions. He was concerned about the validity of the will.
And that's, you said Annie Schuster?
That's the wife.
But okay, what about Anthony? Because I thought that was the one where it says make a will.
Yes.
In the probate. I mean, in strike that, in the guardianship proceeding.
Yes.
That deals with Anthony, not
correct.
Annie, right? That, I'm getting a little confused. So
it deals with Anthony.
So where is Anthony's will, and when is that in Attorney Barrick's hands?
And that's what I'm getting to.
Okay, I'm
how
sorry.
Did he know? Yeah, how did he know there was a will? I think your question is. And I've just given three reasons. Why would you go into court and want to depose people about a will if you don't know there's a will?
To find out if there is one, if you don't know? I don't know. I'm trying to figure it out.
Right.
You know, having done some probate proceedings, things change. You know, people file things, and they may think they've got the right will, or they may think that they have one that was valid, and then they find out there was an amended one or one in a safe deposit box, or I don't know, but things do change from time to time in court. So I'm just trying to sort out
right.
what he knew when he filed the document. That's all.
In the record, Mr. Barrick testified that he was suspicious. He testified on a number of occasions he was suspicious there was a will. It's OLR's position he knew there was a will. Mr. von Schneider, Mr. Barrick called Mr. von Schneider, who witnessed both wills, and he asked him about witnessing both wills. And Mr. von Schneider said, I witnessed both wills. In the record is a conversation that is typed out by the respondent of Mr. von Schneider's discussion with Mr. Barrick. So now he's talked to the witness of both wills. Now, there is some testimony by Mr. Barrick that he wasn't sure Mr. von Schneider knew what he witnessed, but I'll provide a cite to the transcript that shows that Mr. von Schneider did tell him he witnessed the Schuster's will. Also, there was a hearing on September 19, 2008, at that hearing, Ms. Granger was in the courtroom, Mr. Barrick was in the courtroom, and Mr. Binzak was in the courtroom. And at that hearing, Mr. Binzak told Mr. Barrick there was a will. There's another point. Also,
when was that, counsel? What's the date?
The hearing in the circuit court was September 19, 2008.
Is this before Anthony died or after?
Mr. Schuster died in January 2009. Also, if you look at Exhibit 107, the letter that Ms. Respondent sent to his client, Marilyn Granger, says, quote, consistent with our research, we discovered that there was a highly questionable will executed on May 5, 2005. The date is obviously wrong. It was really executed June 24, 2005. But this is a letter he sent to his client that he knew about a questionable will. At the bottom of that, it also says, if this will was a product of undue influence, as you suspect, by Anthony Binzak, then we need to establish the following two elements in order to prove the same. So there's a letter that also says to his client, we've got a will here. Exhibit 117.
What was the date of that letter?
Excuse me?
What was the date of the letter that you referred to?
Date of the letter, June 20. Oops, excuse me. Letter was January 18th. I'm sorry, I don't have the year.
So you don't know if it's before or after the death?
Exhibit 107 has the date.
Okay.
I believe it was before the death.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Exhibit 117 of respondent is a telephone conversation between Attorney Barrick and Dr. Michael Miller. That also has a conversation which the court should review. It's essentially the Dr. Weiser case, Mr. Barrick, his guardianship. In his guardianship of June 2007, he did a will. And the whole question is whether or not he was competent to do the will at that time. That was Mr. Barrick's statement. Doctor, so is his niece trying to make the will not valid or something? Attorney Barrick, it's not a question of making it valid. The question is determining whether or not he was mentally competent, because it has a bearing on how his estate is going to be handled. So at that point, he also is stating there's a will.
That's June 2007 at the guardianship hearing. Is that what you're saying? You're reading from the transcript?
That is, I really apologize. It is, Exhibit 117 is prior to the death of Mr. Schuster, but the date is on the exhibit. And another assistance in whether Mr. Barrick was aware there was a will. In the summary judgment affidavit, there is OLR's first request to admit or deny to respondent pursuant to 804.11. Request number 46 is included in the summary judgment affidavit. The request is, on September 18, 2008, respondent was in court for a formal hearing, during which he was informed of the existence of Anthony Schuster's will by Attorney Binzak. Respondent's answer. Respondent admits that on the date and at the place indicated, Mr. Binzak asserted to respondent that a purported will existed, but not that the same was valid.
But not what?
Not that the same was valid. So again, we have Mr. Barrick being informed by numerous people prior to the death of Mr. Schuster that there was a will.
What should Mr. Barrick have done on that form? What should he have done to avoid these proceedings?
In looking at the form, respondent states, and if you look at the record and read it, that he saw that the form, and let me please get it in front of me.
That appendix 114, I think. If you're talking about the petition for formal administration.
Right. Form PR 1901.
In the red brief, anyway, it's at 114.
He states repeatedly during this proceeding, disciplinary proceeding, that he knew that this form shall not be modified, and I would direct the court to the bottom of both pages. It says, this form shall not be modified.
That's on the bottom, or it's somewhere on every single form that the Records Management Committee puts out.
Yes.
As a form under whatever SCR or whatever statute that's involved. You understand that?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, and that language is on the bottom of both pages. The record is replete with Mr. Barrick stating he read that. The record is not replete with Mr. Barrick going to the next part. And Judge Vogel asked him that. Why don't you refer anywhere in this proceeding about it may be supplemented with additional material? That's on the bottom of both forms, right next to the this form shall not be modified. So
if you look at page 2, it does look like he attached something, right?
No.
It says see attached for names and addresses of interested people.
Not to the original one, no. Oh, I don't believe he did. I have to check. But what he didn't do is what we have is a record of Mr. Barrick being informed many, many times that there is a will. And number 7 says, I made diligent inquiry and I'm going to not aware of any unrevoked will of the decedent, and believe that the decedent died without a will. And that's where the misconduct occurs.
So you think that he should not have checked that box, right?
If he checked it, although I don't know how under these facts, how he could say the decedent died without a will, if he checked it, he should have told the judge that there was a will. Now that's kind of
Did he ever see this will, according to the record? Did he ever see any will? Never saw any will.
He says he never saw the will.
Did he see the will of
yes.
Annie Schuster?
That's why he called the witness Mr. Von Schneider. That's what Mr. Von Schneider told him. That
did he have a copy of Annie Schuster's will?
Yes.
But he was he ever told precisely there is a will and where it is?
In the deposition at page, I'm sorry, the transcript of the proceedings, at page 109, question, Mr. Von Schneider told you he signed and witnessed Anthony Schuster's will, correct? Answer, I would have to look at that statement, but I believe that was his understanding, yes.
Counsel, what was the other choice on the form?
Number six, the decedent died leaving a ex will and give a date. I believe these documents were executed properly and are valid. I've made diligent inquiry and am unaware of subsequent revocation of these documents.
So you had to have, in order to check that box, you had to have some knowledge about the date of the will that was executed. Is that correct?
Yes, but that's what the supplementation is for. All attorneys know that this is a mandatory form. You can staple whatever you want to the rest of it.
But you also have to know that the documents are executed properly and are valid, and then fill in the personal representative or trustee, right?
Right, and what an attorney would do is, it's a probate matter. What is the most fundamental thing that a judge in probate, a circuit court judge, needs to know? Is there a will or isn't there a will? Did Mr. Barrick know there was a will? He certainly did.
If you didn't check either one of those boxes, could the probate begin?
Yes.
Okay, so he could have just
If he didn't?
Did not check either one, could the probate begin?
I don't know, but I think he has to advise the court if he's filing. Again, it's a fundamental tenet of probate court. Is there a will or isn't there a will?
I understand that. But I also think that the statement has been made that he, though other people may have told him about that, no one gave him the will, right? In fact, didn't the attorney who drafted the will tell him it was none of his business when he called up about it?
And it wasn't. However,
it may not have been, and that's my question to you. What if he left both of the boxes open? This form was filed, 2 days after the death of Mr. Schuster?
Yes.
Okay, so in those 2 days, if he hadn't seen the will and he didn't check either box, could the probate go forward or would the court just kick out the proceedings?
I think that the court would have been questioned what was going on. Mm-hmm. If you're filing for informal or petition for formal probate and you don't tell the court if there's a will or not, well, then the judge is going to be on notice that, you know, there's an issue.
Okay, now in the form that's in the appendix, it says C attached on the second page, item number 8. But what was provided to us, and I haven't gone back to the record, I'm just using the appendices, has nothing attached. So my question is to you, first of all, do you know what was attached?
I think there may have been, and I don't know this for sure, I know there was nothing which indicated that Mr. Barrick had knowledge of the will. Nothing. What I do know is he may have, indeed, noticed those who are in line intestate succession. What is interesting is, although he had read, and this goes to a point previously made, although he had read Annie Schuster's will, which stated that over $1.5 million was going to three churches, he didn't. And Mr. Von Schneider told him he witnessed both wills. He did not initially notice the churches.
Did he notice the attorney that drafted Annie's will?
I don't know when he did that, but he did.
So you don't know if that was attached to what was filed in probate court or not?
What?
As it says, see attached, you don't know if the attorney who drafted Mr. Schuster's will was one of those names and addresses attached to the petition for probate.
I don't think it was. I don't think that the attorney was an interested party because he drafted the will. I think he noticed the intestate succession parties, non-will, died without a will, he noticed those parties. All the people who didn't have a right to $1.5 million, he noticed. He didn't notice the churches.
Counsel, your position seems to be that Attorney Barrick should have written a statement saying that he knew of the existence of a will. Is that your position?
He should have supplemented the form like attorneys are supposed to.
So the answer to my question is yes.
Yes. He should have.
And so would that be entirely accurate, though? Wouldn't it have to be something like, gee, I've heard that there may have been a will executed. I don't know the circumstances, and I don't know about its validity, and I don't know whether it exists today.
He should have told the circuit court judge that he knew of a will.
A will that may or may not be in existence. We all know that any one of us can go execute a will at 2 o'clock this afternoon and rip it up at 3 o'clock.
That's true. We don't have any evidence that that happens.
Let me ask you this. It's one thing to me if you file something with the court and you go ahead and you go down the line and you're proceeding trying to get this done without anybody knowing what the truth is. It's another thing to me if you're getting the ball rolling and you're trying to get answers to things that you've been previously unable to get answers to. What was this? When did Attorney Binzik, he's the one who drafted the will, right? Attorney Binzik, was he the one who drafted the will?
He did, yes.
When did he have noticed that this formal petition for formal administration was filed?
After Mr.
How many hearings happened with the court where he tried to convince the court there was no will? How far did this go down the road with him proceeding, saying, no will here, just appoint my client, nothing to worry about, court? Tell me what happened so I know. Is this one where he was really trying to hoodwink the court into thinking there was no will?
Yes.
Or is this one where he was really trying to figure out what do we have to deal with here? Because the second happens all the time. I mean, even in a variety of cases, you get a personal injury case. Someone files saying they have permanency. The lawyer may figure out, boy, I really don't have permanency. Because they filed a complaint alleging permanency, are they... I mean, is that now a violation of the code because they didn't really have something indicating they had permanency at the time they filed it? They just thought that'd be an issue that would be developed? I don't know. I mean, I'm trying to figure it out. Where's the line?
The judge was informed of the existence of the will by Attorney Maris from M&I Bank, who was the...
In the probate proceeding.
It was...
I'm not talking about the 05 Washington County case, but this is Waukesha County, right?
Right.
The probate for the will is in Waukesha County.
Yes.
In 05, there was a guardianship in Washington County, I think, if I'm looking at the documents right. Right? Those are two separate proceedings, right?
Yes.
Okay. So when in the formal administration, how far did that go down the line before the discussion about a will occurred?
I can say up until Attorney Maris told the circuit court judge that he was a guardianship of Schuster's estate and that he was filing the wills up until that point when the judge got the wills in hand, Mr. Barrick never told the court. It was Mr. Maris who informed the court of the existence and gave the wills.
When did Mr. Maris get notice of the formal administration proceeding?
I don't know how long it was, but I don't think that's relevant. The issue is, why didn't Mr. Barrick tell the judge immediately when he filed this form? He misrepresented
the information. You can't have an ex parte communication. I mean, if he didn't attach it, you wait till you have a hearing, and then you figure out what's happening in this case.
The respondent didn't have to wait for the hearing. He knew at the time he placed that in front of a circuit court judge that there was a will.
Counselor, I think that what Justice Ziegler is trying to nail down a little bit is what was the effect of actually filing the form you object to. In order to learn the effect, you have to know when the probate court found out there was a will. So do you know the date? I understand it's when Attorney Maris gave it to the court, but do you know when that occurred? This probate was filed on the 16th of January, so when after that did that occur?
I will answer that, but it is irrelevant. As
you
to
may
his
think
comment.
It's irrelevant, yes. But I'm asking the question, and I think it's relevant.
I'm just trying to not get off of Mr. Maris complied with what he was supposed to do. I don't
That's
know if it was
fine.
A week.
Can
I don't
you
know
answer
if it was,
my question, please?
I don't know if it was a week or 2 weeks, but I can tell you that is in the exhibits that I filed with the court.
All right.
It's in the record.
Well, it seems to me that a very serious allegation has arisen in regard to the referee's conduct here. I wonder, do you think we should be concerned at all about his cutting off testimony in regard to when Mr. Barrick sought advice from an experienced court commissioner in Milwaukee County, and whether we should be concerned if, I mean, well, do you agree that the record indicates that the court, that the referee had begun dictating his opinion or his decision in this matter prior to the conclusion of the hearing? And if so, should we be concerned about that?
What wasn't provided to the court, that Judge Vokey specifically told counsel, I usually do this way. You can stay or you can leave, but I'm doing this for my own purposes. I'm going to use the court reporter to make notes for myself. And that's what he did. There was a letter thereafter of objection by counsel that he shouldn't have done that. And I followed up with a letter saying Judge Vokey was very clear. He does this in every case. He makes notes for himself. He utilizes the court reporter, and he makes some findings. And then thereafter, those were provided to us.
He makes the findings, did you just say? He makes the findings before the closing argument?
We had a summary judgment matter, which he had concluded and made findings of fact based upon the summary judgment.
Before closing argument?
You know,
I don't know the answer to that question. They say yes. I'm asking you.
It's false. Judge Vokey did not state that we weren't going to get closing arguments. He provided that to us. He was making notes for himself. And I sent a letter to the court when there was an objection saying it was very clear that Judge Vokey does this in all cases. He makes a record. Counsel, you don't need to stay if you don't want to stay.
Counsel, I understand an attack on the referee. I don't know whether it's a valid or invalid attack, but I understand that in part because we have here evidence, some of it circumstantial, about knowledge, according to the referee, and some of it direct. I guess I would refer to that telephone conversation between the medical doctor, it's on appendix page 108, between the medical doctor and Attorney Barrick regarding the competency to do a will. So that was the direct testimony, according to the referee, that indicates prior knowledge. But then, based on the circumstantial evidence, and including this direct testimony, the referee concludes that he knew of the existence of the will at the relevant time. So that's a finding of fact that can only be disturbed unless by a reviewing court unless it's clearly erroneous.
Yes.
So I think, I don't know how you can find, especially since there was a determination by the referee that to be, quote, and I'm reading from Appendix 106, to be blunt, the referee is saying, that the attorney Barrick was not a good witness. He did himself a great deal of damage, and frankly, he made OLR's case for them on both direct and cross-examination independent of my previous findings, he says, by the way. This is on page 106. So it seems to me that that's a pretty high burden to once you have a fact finder that based on circumstantial evidence and direct evidence makes a finding that this attorney really knew. That is not a legal conclusion. That's a finding of fact. It's got to be, only can be disturbed unless it's clearly erroneous. Hard on this record to do that. So I think the way you got to attack it, I'm not saying this isn't correct. I'm just saying that you got to attack the
fact finding.
Integrity of the record.
And so that's an important issue.
It is, and I reviewed that. I know my red light is on. I reviewed that in detail. If you go to the record, Judge Vokey at two occasions made a record that he spent two and a half days preparing for the matter, reviewing everybody's documents, and he made a record of that. And even thereafter, you'll find in the record, Judge Vokey made other findings about how he reviewed everybody's documents. He allowed witnesses. He allowed cross-examination. If you look at the record itself, briefs were filed on all the issues. At one point, he said, right now, all I need to hear is from Mr. Barak, after he made his findings on summary judgment. However, if you want more witnesses, just give me a call. We'll notice them up. I received no call about more witnesses. When I got to the disciplinary hearing, counsel brought another witness. I made a rather flimsy objection because I figured that, you know, the judge was going to allow it. Judge Vokey allowed it. He was methodical. He was fair. He was unbiased. And he went through the hearing in a methodical fashion. You can look at all the briefs that were filed, check the transcripts. Anybody who needed to bring witnesses in, they were allowed to do so. He was, Your Honors, patient in this case.
Counsel, I have to ask, and usually I don't ask questions when the red light is on.
But
I really need to in this case. I still don't understand. Did the referee make findings of fact before he ruled on the summary judgment motion?
No.
Well, explain this sequence to me. You keep telling us that, oh, he marked things with the court reporter. And what did he do? Tell us sequence-wise how this went.
And procedurally, if you take a look at the record, you'll get the dates and everything. But all our filed, first we had a scheduling order, a very, very detailed scheduling order. Attached to the scheduling order was 6 pages of how you're supposed to file your summary judgment. There was a scheduling conference where counsel were informed with specificity how to file their summary judgment motions. There was a draft of the scheduling order. Then there was a final scheduling order sent to everybody. Then there was a motion filed by OLR for summary judgment, which we prevailed on regarding the facts. The judge ordered in part, these are the facts. The judge sua sponte made findings also on notice pleading. He took the answer and he took the complaint and he made findings. With regard to those findings, he then scheduled a disciplinary hearing and allowed anybody to bring in any witnesses, any proof. Exhibits were filed and had a hearing on that. But
was that hearing just in regard to sanctions?
No.
It was in regard to whether there was a violation?
Disciplinary hearing, if you look at the orders. It was a disciplinary hearing where witnesses were called, exhibits were offered, exhibits were seized. What happened here was the summary judgment motion was granted in part as to facts, findings of facts. And although we went to the disciplinary, and if you look at the Selmer case, this court handed down a decision in the Selmer case. In that, I'll give you the cite, 227 West 2nd, 85. That involves a summary judgment motion, wherein this court affirmed the referee's granting of summary judgment. However, in that case, while there was a granting of summary judgment in full, in our case, it was a summary judgment. If you look at what the judge, Judge Vokey, ordered, in part, he did not, and it says in the order, come to conclusions of law until he finished a full disciplinary hearing.
But he made findings of fact based on a summary judgment motion.
This is done.
So he made it without testimony, but with affidavits? Or what was he basing the findings of fact on? Or were they, if they're uncontested, I don't have a problem. But if they're contested, I probably
If you go to the record received on August 13, 2010, you'll find OLR's affidavit in support of summary judgment and propose the judge asked us to give proposed findings of fact.
Okay.
And in that, you will find every fact supported by an affidavit, a certified record, 80208, and the judge's scheduling, 6-page scheduling order. We complied to a T.
Now, that's just like, that's the, pretty much the federal process for summary judgment. And
yes.
It's not what's usually used in state court, but it's what the federal courts have used for a long, long time.
Yes.
And so if you don't controvert those facts in federal court, then the court just finds them. So is that what happened here, that Attorney Brock didn't controvert the facts, and so that's why they were found by the trial court at summary judgment?
What counsel did was he failed to comply with the scheduling order. He failed to provide any of the supportive affidavits, any of the certified records. He just filed essentially a brief memorandum with no support to it. It was received by Judge Vokey. It was absolutely in noncompliance with 80208 and his six-page scheduling order, summary judgment order of the court.
I see. Thank you very much.
And when he failed to do that, Judge Vokey gave leave at counsel's request to file for an extension. Yes, sir, you can file your motion. And if you go to page 44 and 66 of the transcript, there was a hearing on the request to extend for the respondent to file. And it's a detailed explanation regarding excusable neglect, statutes cited, and found that there was no excusable neglect. We then went forward. My opinion is that if you look at the August 13, 2010 filing of OLR, we provided the court with, provided the referee with proof of each and every allegation in the complaint.
Chief, may I just ask one short question?
Justice Ziegler.
Counsel, referee Volke is probably 4 hours away from Waukesha, and you're going to ask for costs and you're going to ask for fees. Was there no one closer to this area who could have acted as referee? I'm stepping aside from the what referee Volke did, but I'm just curious because as we assess these things, we try to figure out what's fair, what's reasonable, what you ask for if we just...
With all due respect, OLR has no authority to appoint referees.
Okay.
I believe I know who appoints them.
The clerk does.
Okay, so...
The clerk has a list of referees. The clerk sends me a order. It has no names of the people, and I sign whatever the clerk does so that the court, in effect, is not determining who will be the original decision maker. And it's done by the clerk's office on whatever basis, partly territorial, partly on who's available.
Yes.
Partly who doesn't have cases pending now, et cetera. But
okay.
That is not done by the
works.
Court.
Yes. It just seems far. I mean, when I appointed lawyers in cases, I tried to get lawyers that, you know, you wouldn't have all that extra money built in to travel.
I think Judge Vokey was pretty efficient with his time getting down here. He said he used
I'm not it. Quarreling with that. I just didn't know how it worked, and now I do. The chief appoints people.
I'll just say I refer the court to SCR 20.1.0G. It defines knowingly. I refer the court to 20.1.0H. It defines misrepresentation. And SCR 20.1.0E, it defines fraud or fraudulent. And that will assist the court as it looks through the Supreme Court rules that were violated. Thank you.
And the sanction?
Excuse me?
And the sanction that the OLR recommends?
Is 120 days. There is in the transcript.
Do we do days or we do months? The sanction days or months?
Good question. Herein, it's 120 days.
Okay. Because we do 6 months.
We do 4 months. We do 90 days and 60 days.
There was a reference regarding sanction, and I believe Justice Bradley. In the report, Judge Vokey refers to the previous Judge Flynn, I believe it was, and provides an indication of the previous misconduct. OLR submits it's the same type of misconduct herein. It's a repeat pattern of behavior. There is a direct quote in his decision report, Judge Vokey's report. He quotes the judge.
What are the costs so far, counsel?
Oops.
You'll have to.
Approximately is fine.
You know, I don't realize that's 4,000. 4,000 is about 13,000, I believe.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Five minutes is not a lot of time to deal with a vast array of, I hope, inadvertently erroneous information provided to you. Justice Gable, let's start with your question. Here's what happened. At the end of the hearing, Judge Volke indicated that he was going to dictate some notes to the reporter so he would have them available, that we could stay early. He didn't indicate he was going to be making factual findings. He didn't indicate he was going to be making any sort of preliminary draft of his decision. He indicated nothing of the kind. He then proceeded to do exactly that before we argued.
He proceeded to do exactly what, counsel?
Dictate a partial decision, making findings and comments about the evidence that he'd heard before we argued the case. When we got done, the record will show I strongly objected. I said it was a denial of my client's right to due process. It was not what he said he had done, and I was astounded, just literally astounded that that's what had happened. I don't consider myself to be that brilliant, but I'd like to think that when I argue a case, it's of some value to somebody. And he had, to a significant part, decided the case without listening to my argument or OLS counsel's argument.
Well, I decided the facts, right?
Well, since he's essentially the fact finder, and as Justice Bradley has pointed out, you really, by statute, don't do much of a review of what he does. It's pretty much accepting what he says. A lot of the case is over when he gets done. Not to mention, when he found facts against us with no notice on the summary judgment, he'd done it once before. Perhaps in retrospect, I ought not have been surprised that he was doing it again.
Counsel, are you able on this record to make an argument that the findings of fact are clearly erroneous, but for the argument of attacking the procedure?
I think the finding that my client intentionally misrepresented facts to the court is clearly erroneous on this record. But I agree with what you said. That's not really the main issue here on the fact issue. The main issue is if, to use an overstated example, if we had the same rule here and you found out someone bribed a juror, would we be talking about whether or not the record supported the findings? No. We'd say the trier of fact was so tainted that we don't care what his findings were. We start over.
And that's really your argument. I mean, he made a historical fact finding that on January 16th he knew. I mean, it seems to me that's hard based on the circumstantial evidence.
Well, no, it depends. That's a conclusion that says because people told you something, you knew. That's someone just got done telling you he didn't make any findings in the record but before the argument. Well, you knew that. Unfortunately, of course, it's completely wrong. He did. And as a matter of fact, there's a record of it. He just wouldn't let it be printed. Direct him to print it. You'll get a transcript. I presume the court reporter didn't destroy the transcript because afterwards I wrote and I said, now that I've had a chance to think about it and realized what madness went on there, having jurors, in effect, making decisions before they hear closing argument, I'd like a record of what you did. Counsel objected. He had clearly said he wouldn't do it, and he stood by his guns. He is resolute. I will give him that. He is like a good judge, often wrong, but never uncertain.
I don't know about the often. It's supposed to be seldom wrong.
That's the judge's version. I gave you the lawyer's version. Second, as to the chronology of events.
That's your characterization of a good judge, counsel. I'd hate to hear what a bad judge gets.
I hope the record reflects the tongue-in-cheek aspect of that. As to the series of events and the suggestion by counsel that the court might have done something before all was revealed, it's completely wrong. All you have to do is look at page 7 of our brief, the citation of facts there. Within days of the date this petition was filed, my client had sent letters to everyone, including Mr. Maris, because he represented M&I, which was the guardian by virtue of earlier proceedings, and literally within days of January 16th, the wills were filed, all was revealed. And why was it? Because my client went to lengths he didn't have to go to make sure that would happen. And yet, you are asked to infer that his motivation was to fraudulently misrepresent facts. There is no evidence in this record that any judge ever saw that petition before all the facts were reformed, or that there was any chance that any judge would.
Where in the record can I find the dates on which the letters were sent to the attorney who drafted the will and Attorney Maris?
The citations to the record are summarized. I can give you the easy place to find it. It's all on page 7 of our brief, page 7 to the top of page 8. But the record sites are all there. There are also exhibits. Some of the letters are exhibits that will be referenced in the testimony at those pages.
Counsel, do I have this wrong or right? Did Attorney Barrick call Attorney Benzik and inquire about the will before he filed the petition for formal administration? Receive calls back from Attorney Benzik, filed it, and then wrote him a letter within days of filing the petition for formal administration, to which it appears Attorney Merrick responded and said there is a will.
Yes, and that was not the first time he'd asked Mr. Benzik for the will. I would tell you, as I get older, I get somewhat more cynical. When I've asked for the will several times, and everyone keeps telling me that it exists and no one will give it to me or even show it to me, I start to hear there is no will. Right? And I don't know how we get from someone saying something to saying there is a will. If I could just mention one last point, because there was one other issue that I thought was raised. Repeated references were made by counsel for OLR that he told the judge something, that he represented to the judge, that he was hoodwinking the judge. There is no evidence whatsoever that the judge ever saw this form or ever would see it, or that he ever would have any knowledge of this form before it was all explained to him at the first hearing. The evidence is only to the contrary. This is a suggestion that has been made by OLR, a suggestion made by the referee, but there has never been any evidence to support it. It is simply imagined. And it is imagined with a bad purpose. It is imagined so that you will think, you will see this in your minds as a representation by my client about facts he supposedly knew, as opposed to things he'd been told, about which he was justifiably and intensely suspicious, that he knew would not be communicated to the court, knew were not important, and instead he took the steps necessary to tell the people that were important. The last point is, I will tell you, what's attached to the petition is a listing of the statutorily defined interested parties. It does not include Mr. Benzik because he's not a statutorily defined interested party. Therefore, he didn't have to be written to. My client went above and beyond the duty by writing to him and Mr. Maris.
I notice in the guardianship papers, Attorney Benzik was also notified.
Yes.
And why was that?
I believe because he was counsel for Mr. Schuster, but I honestly do not recall that. It may just have been that he was known to have someone with an interest. I mean, I expect Mr. Barrick, like many of us, I send copies of letters to lots of lawyers when I have court proceedings that I don't strictly have to send them to because, frankly, it's easier and you don't have to worry too much about who you send it to and who you don't. You overserve.
I gather that there are two counts here, right?
There are two counts, one of which cites two rules and one of which cites one rule.
Right. And the first rule that is cited deals with
the client in committing a fraud.
That's right. So it's the client that signed this probate form, and he signed it as the lawyer. The second count relates to the same basic evidence.
Correct. It's what is true in OLR's charging in many cases, conduct. One act can be argued to be fall within the parameters of several different rules. There's really only one act here.
That's it. 23.3A3, which is a lawyer shall not knowingly offer evidence that the lawyer knows to be false. If a lawyer, lawyer's client, or witness called by the lawyer has offered material evidence, and the lawyer comes to know the falsity, then you make changes. That's 3A3. This is as to the second count, if I understand this. 20:84C. So was there, before I leave that, was there offering of evidence?
No.
Just the probate form, is that viewed as evidence?
If it is, there's no evidence in the record to suggest that it is. I'm happily ignorant of probate, but I see no evidence that it is evidence.
Okay. 20:84C says it is professional misconduct for a lawyer to engage in conduct involving dishonesty, fraud, deceit, or misrepresentation, right?
Correct. And that's why I see this as involving the question, was it conduct involving dishonesty, fraud, deceit, or misrepresentation for Mr. Barrack to have participated in and assisted in filling out the form, whether it's the client filling out the form with his assistance or his own conduct. The technicality escapes me, to be perfectly truthful.
Trying to think through whether you can, your client can, has to be exonerated of all the both counts, or can be found violating one of the counts and not the other.
In theory, my client could be exonerated of one, but not both. In fact, under the facts of this case, I do not see how one does not go with the other. I believe he's not guilty of either. If he's guilty of one, I don't think I can argue he's not guilty of both.
1.2D talks about fraudulent, right?
And we discussed that at
That's
length in
count
our brief.
One. Mm-hmm. And the second count, which is professional misconduct, D, get my numbers straight here, 84C, engage in dishonesty, fraud, deceit, or misrepresentation. And as I remember discussing this in another case, whether they are four different items there or just really one.
And it, from our point of view, it doesn't make that, – that's angels dancing on the head of a pin, I think. In this case, all of them require, as we demonstrated in our brief, an intent to deceive, to be dishonest, to defraud, and therefore that's the issue regardless of which term you apply.
All right. So 8.4C overlaps with 1.2D.
Under the facts of this case, I believe it does, yes.
In terms of fraudulent.
Yes. Okay. If I could just mention two quick thoughts, I realize I've passed my time. Number one, I won't go through a chapter and verse, but I ask you that if you seriously think Judge Volke handled the summary judgment correctly and that he handled our motion to file the findings and the written direct response to the findings 4 days late, correctly, read the record. Contrary to what was said, we did file affidavits. We simply didn't respond to the findings because of an error in our calendaring system. This is form over substance at its worst. Number two, question was raised, why didn't we notify the churches when we sent out the letters? We didn't know about the churches. We didn't have the will. We couldn't write to the churches because we had no way of knowing that the churches were beneficiaries of Mr. Schuster's will.
Were they beneficiaries of Annie Schuster's will?
Correct.
And was Annie Schuster's will executed on the same date as Mr. Schuster's will?
Yes. My wife and I have wills executed on the same date. She likes different charities than I do. Our contingent beneficiaries are not the same.
And Annie Schuster's will, were the beneficiaries the same under both wills?
As it turns out, yes, they were essentially the same.
And under both wills, our nephews were not beneficiaries. Is that correct?
The money went to the churches. And the reason it went there ultimately is because there was an earlier will of Mr. Schuster that provided the same thing. No reason to argue. For once, the lawyer saw it the right way and said, since it makes no difference, we won't spend money arguing about it. And the last thing that I want to mention on that is my client, as soon as he did know the churches were beneficiaries under the will, when Mr. Maris filed the will, immediately sent letters to them as well. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Before I close this hearing, let me introduce students who I hope and think are Deerfield High School students. Would they please stand? We've been expecting you. We're sorry you caught in traffic, but are delighted you heard part of this argument. You may be seated. I told the other students who are here that you are here with the Court with Class program that you all know about. But what I didn't do, which I'll do now, is introduce the Court to all the students and then tell you the justice with whom you're going to speak today after the second argument. On my far left is Justice Michael Gableman. He is the justice assigned today to meet with you at noon and discuss the procedures of this case, not the substantive issues. Seated next to him is Justice Patience Rogensack. To my immediate left is Justice Patrick Crooks. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my immediate right is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. And to her right, Justice David Prosser. And on the far right, Justice Annette Ziegler. With those introductions made and with our completed presentation about the Court with Class program, I'll call an end to this proceeding and thank both counsel for their arguments today. As counsel know, these are always difficult cases for counsel, for the respondent lawyer, and for the court. 09AP2917D, Office of Lawyer Regulation versus Mitchell Barrack, is completed. The court will take a few moments of recess to allow these students to leave and other students to enter the courtroom, and we will be back shortly.